I marched across it, committed to making the man who in all likelihood would soon run all the Kendall County courts an enemy for life. I gave Toohey a look as grave and level as I could muster, and said that Robbie Fever was a tough guy and not the kind to share his woes. He did not understand why anybody would want to make trouble for him, but he was a stoic and would take the weight of whatever came his way. From the withered depth that gave his light eyes an aspect of privacy, Toohey's look remained on me as he evaluated the message. "Ah," said Brendan slowly, "so he's okay?" "I was sure of that," I said, with no wavering. "And you'll let me know if there's any change. I want to help however I can." Departing, Toohey shook again with a fierce two-handed grip, pleased with me and himself and my assurance that Robbie was a stand-up guy. He'd given another bravura performance, finding out what he needed without admitting a thing. His remark that Robbie'd seemed irregular might even have loosed a weevil of doubt about the reliability of anything Robbie had let slip to me, although I'd done my best to convey the impression that Favor had told me nothing. "You didn't have to do that, George," Robbie said, when I shared the details of my encounter with Brendan. We sat in the parking lot of a McDonald's near his home where I'd stopped on my way from the office that evening. Together we watched the young moms coping with the anguish of dinner time. Robbie was sharp to the nuances of practice and knew the burden I was taking on if Toohey escaped. I reassured him that I'd chosen to do it, but I had one request.
"Anything,"
he answered. "Let's not tell Senate," I said. Chapter 35. On Friday at noon, Eva made a trip to Favors, carrying an urgent message. She found him in no state for visitors. He answered the door in tears. Like a child, he wiped his eyes on the sleeve of his polo shirt as she stepped into the marble foyer. Her first thought was to leave, but he took hold of her wrist, clearly craving company.
"We were talking," he said, "about kids. I mean, you understand?"
His black eyes briefly rose to her as if the look alone betrayed a secret. And it did. Even for once immediately made the connection. Rainey must have indicated that she did not have the same reasons to continue her life she might have if she were a mother.
"You mean, you know, regrets?"
he asked.
"Millions. But that's number one. Kids."
They were on the long white sofa in the living room where Robbie had first faced the IRS agents last fall. She had no place to ask for details, but Robbie, as ever, spoke.
"It was always an issue. I was for kids. I mean, I was afraid of fucking up like my father, but, you know, I wanted the chance to do better. But Lorraine, with that screwy upbringing of hers, it became kind of a manana thing. She had her job, and wow, she made big money. And then, you know, it was trouble. I made trouble. She was always with one foot out the door, and I'd say I'd mend my ways, and I didn't. And then, to teach me a lesson, she did some stuff. But when we got the news, whatever it was, 3 years ago, I was like, no, wait 1 minute. We were just about to get this right. I think we would have. I do. Every New Year's for maybe 5 years, it was my last loopy thought right before I crashed through into sleep. This year we're pregnant." Before she got diagnosed, we were talking about it more. We even named this kid we didn't have. I mean, goofy names. Sparky, Flipper. We'd toss around funny things the kid would do. Don't get pizza with olives. She won't eat olives. It was always a girl, I don't know why. And somehow we got to doing that just now. He'd been staring straight into the high pile of the white carpet. But unexpectedly, a comic thought came to relieve him, impelling a brief laugh. "We got a great name today, I said, I want a nice Jewish name. We'd just finished this book she really liked. So she looks over there and says, Nancy Taylor Rosenberg. So that's who we were going on about, Nancy Taylor Rosenberg. Nancy Taylor Rosenberg needs sunglasses for her big blue eyes. Nancy Taylor Rosenberg has an Audi like her mother. Every screwy thing. Nancy Taylor Rosenberg loves chocolate cake and has terrible allergies. We really got rolling. We were both bawling our eyes out, but we kept going for 20 minutes. So, he said in abrupt conclusion and slapped his thighs, what's up?
She eyed him, not sure he was ready for business, but he indicated she should proceed. Sig Milaki had called this morning and wanted Robbie to phone. The next move was at hand.
Sig, he said, and considered the message slip. She had brought the phone trap. The device used to record the call was a tiny earpiece the size of a good hearing aid. The earplug was mic'd to pick up both the signal from the telephone handset and Robbie's voice, which was transmitted through the bones of his skull. The lead ran to a portable tape recorder she'd brought in her briefcase. Alf had wanted to do this himself, but as always now, the fear was he might be tailed. Listening in on an extension, even could hear Milaki approach the phone from a distance, assailing his underlings with gruff wisecracks.
Fever!
He proceeded with his standard banter, jibes about attorneys. His daughter, Milaki said, had now finished her first semester in law school.
I'm watching her real careful, he confided, to see just when it is she grows the second face.
Fuck you, Sig.
Be the best piece of ass you ever had, Milaki exploded in raw laughter.
He loved that line and repeated it several times. Finally, he explained himself.
Sort of wanted to catch a look at your ugly mug. Thought maybe we could have a soda pop. Six, okay, at that yuppie-duppie joint of yours with the $6 brewskis?
Robbie tried to get a hint of what the meeting was about, but Milaki roared as if Robbie had told another joke, and with no more, ended the call. At 6:05, Robbie strolled into Attitude, as he had on many another Friday night. Perhaps it was the familiar atmosphere or his acting skills, but he looked far better than he had in days. He was in an Italian sharkskin suit, his big hair blown dry, his cologne, as always, redolent for yards around. For Klecker, getting a decent recording amid the shattering ambient noise of a Friday night crowd presented a technician's nightmare. To deal with that, Alf had wired three of Amari's surveillance team members with directional mics in the hope they could work their way close to Robbie and capture better sound. To augment the problematic audio, both Klecker and Sennett wanted cameras. The jostling in the hurly-burly of the bar made a stable picture unlikely, and in the meeting at McManus's beforehand, Favor had claimed that he'd dislocate a shoulder if he had to stand there holding the ponderous briefcase camera for an hour. Ultimately, Klecker had dispatched another member of the surveillance squad with that unit, instructing her to take a table on the loft level, where she'd get a good wide-angle image of the entire scene. A second camera was manned downstairs by three agents of Asian descent, two Japanese and one Korean, whom Amari had requisitioned on short notice. The three men were in the middle of the barroom floor. In another of Klecker's inspirations, they played the role of happy tourists, passing what looked to be a video camera back and forth among themselves as they endeavored to record every moment. Only one of the agents spoke any foreign language, but he crowed at volume and the other two laughed and bowed in a vigorous parody of American expectations. To conserve the batteries, none of the cameras were switched on until Robbie entered the bar. In the van, there was the inevitable Zantac moment, waiting to see if the equipment would function. The space here in the rear was extremely confined tonight. It now looked like a TV studio. Klecker had added two video monitors and three additional sound receivers to the pyramided equipment. Tex Clevenger, trained in the Army as a sound tech,
worked with Alf, helping spin the dials. Sennett, McManus, and I did not have room to spread our elbows. In front, Shirley drove. Even was beside her in the passenger seat. Like the rest of us, she'd been provided with headphones, but she listened through only one side, the other ear being already equipped with the infrared receiver hidden under her hair. Robbie's assignment tonight was direct. Try somehow to get another meeting with Brendan. In order to dramatize Favor's desperate need for further advice from Tui, Sennett and McManus had worked out a scenario around Even. Executing this plan depended on how long Robbie remained inside and what Milaki wanted. On that score, there was still no clue. From the audio output alone, it was clear attitude was rocking. The crowd, packed tight from the door, was full of libertine energy. They'd survived another week, had taken the punch, and were ready to make the most of it. Alf flipped between the radio channels, sampling the sound, almost all of it a waterfall of unintelligible chatter, while the tape decks turned. One of the mic'd agents had already ID'd Milaki and was drinking next to him. A second had followed Robbie through the door. A woman whom Robbie knew, a legal secretary who once had worked at Fever and Dinnerstein, pushed up to greet him as soon as he cleared the tall glass doors. Carla. We could see her on the output from the video cam with which the three agents were posing. She was smoking a cigarette and barely remembered to remove it before kissing Favor on the lips. She was conventionally pretty, near Robbie's age. She clutched Robbie's arm above the elbow as she asked him about Mort and shared stories of her two sons, both now in the Marines. Her straight blonde hair, heavily sprayed and treated, divided like a stream around the rock of her shoulders. She licked the ends absent-mindedly as they spoke.
"I'll see you, hon," Robbie said eventually. "I gotta get with a guy."
"That's how it is anymore. Everybody's always running. I'm over by the window with Rick and Kitty."
He blew her a noncommittal kiss and worked his way toward Milaki, who was in the second row of standees near the bar. He had one finger in his ear as he yelled into his cell phone, apparently reaming out somebody who worked for him. When Robbie arrived, Sig pointed at the phone and mouthed an insult about the person on the other end. In the van, Alf signaled, instructing us to switch our headphones to Channel 3. The mic in the briefcase of the surveillance agent who was beside Milaki funneled far clearer sound than Robbie's foxbite.
"Say, listen," Milaki said, and caught Robbie by the arm after they had said hello. "We just had a thing at the courthouse. I swear to God I nearly soiled my skivvies. One of these macaronis with the aluminum foil hairdo, you know, so they don't get too many of them weird ball radio signals from outer space. One of these whackheads goes right through the metal detector. Holy tamale, we got bells and lights like a pinball machine. So the boys pull him over to the wall to frisk him. Here," said Milaki to Robbie. "Here, pick up your arms. I gotta show you this."
On the second monitor, we could see Milaki spread his hands, ready to pat Robbie down.
"Oh, shit," said McManus.
He tried to stand up, forgetting his seatbelt, and was jolted back. After popping it free, he crowded closer to the monitor. There was no mistaking Robbie's hesitation, either. After a second, McManus pushed Even's shoulder and told her to get in there. She looked into the side view to be certain she was clear and jumped out in a rush.
"What's the matter?"
we heard Milaki ask.
"Ticklish?"
"Very."
"Come on, Roberta, I won't pinch. This is a scream."
He hitched his head and still appeared to be smiling. Even in black and white, you could see he had high color and a beautiful widow's peak. Years ago, he'd been a dirty blonde, but his oiled hair was now mostly gray. Robbie raised his arms vaguely, like a suspect unsure about giving up.
"I paid $2,000 at Zegna for this suit, Milaki. I ought to make you wash your hands."
"Right, it's very pretty. So, they go like this,"
he frisked Robbie, starting from the boot tops while he maintained his patter.
"And so help me God, the Jamoki has a 3-foot salami in there, wrapped in tinfoil."
He reached right into Robbie's jacket at that point to feel under the arm.
Can you imagine? We were all laughing so hard I thought somebody'd bust an artery.
In the van, not a breath was taken in the interval.
Where is it?
Sennett asked quietly. Even had initiated today, but McManus said that since acquiring his new footwear, Robbie had made a habit of placing the fox bite in a holster in his boot.
Could he miss the lead?
Sennett asked. It was taped along Robbie's inseam, McManus said, so it was possible. Indeed, Malaki so far had not dropped a beat. He put his arm on Robbie's shoulder, then patted him up and down the back as he racked with laughter. Robbie, on stage again, showed no further sign of flinching, even when Malaki gave him a cheerful clap on the butt. Sensing he'd passed, Robbie, as he explained afterwards, figured the only credible reaction was outrage. He grabbed his suit coat by the lapels to settle it on his shoulders and pointed at the cop.
Why didn't you just bring the fucking metal detector, Sig?
Malaki didn't bother with pretense.
Better safe than sorry, Bunky. Times we live in. Your lady friends made everybody a little jumpy. Maybe it rubs off on you. Couple folks been worrying about you anyway. Said you seemed a little frayed around the collar.
Crowthers and Walter, probably. This wasn't good news either. Robbie kept up his front.
Is that right?
Yeah, there's talk. It's like what Minnie Mouse told the judge when she asked to divorce Mickey. You heard that? She said she had to get out because he's been fucking goofy.
Malaki, taller than Robbie, could see he was getting nowhere with the efforts at humor, but he pounded Favor's shoulder anyway as he roared.
They got a lot at home, Sig.
Hey, fuck, who loves you, baby?
Malaki took his large, ruddy hand and jerked Robbie by the neck, as if trying to shake him into a better mood.
Fellow down the bar would like to see you.
In the van, McManus tapped his heart. In the meanwhile, Sennett leaned toward the top monitor, which displayed a panorama of the entire establishment. Bulling through the happy throng, Robbie seemed to know where he was going.
Tui,
Dan whispered.
Make it Tui.
Kosick, Alf said, and stood for just a second to touch the top screen. Rollo again was at the extreme end of the bar, under the white piano. One of the surveillance agents who'd been tailing Kosick for weeks had spotted him before, and turned out to be on the stool beside him. The pianist, a different one than last time, was accompanying himself, crooning in the style of Tony Bennett, and the music piped up loudly on every channel. Alf spun his dials to little avail and griped, saying what everybody knew. These guys were smart. The trio of Asian agents had apparently kept pace with Robbie crossing the room as a clear image of Kosick suddenly came into focus on the bottom monitor. Rollo was on his third old-fashioned by now. The glasses were lined up on the bar in front of him, the other two empty except for the maraschino cherries, whose stems looked like hands waving for rescue as they sank between the melting cubes. When Favor arrived and greeted Kosick, the surveillance agent seated beside Rollo abruptly picked up his drink, allowing Favor to slide onto the brushed steel stool. Favor's initial words to Rollo were largely lost by the time the applause died down after three coins in the fountain. But Robbie could be seen addressing Kosick, looking forward to the mirror in a dead-eyed, humorless fashion. When his voice came through again, he was talking indignantly about his encounter with Malaki.
Yeah, we just had a touchy-feely, Sig and I. The wrong kind. I had the impression he sort of expected my balls to go beep.
Kosick, much as last time, showed no reaction. Dressed in a golf windbreaker, he lifted his hand toward Lutice, the index finger crooked to hide the bad nail as he signaled for another drink. Then he removed a pen from his jacket pocket and began doodling on a cocktail napkin while Robbie went on.
You know, I respect you, Rollo. Mama brought me up right, and maybe
Okay, maybe my trolley's a little off the tracks these days. They don't need anybody's shoulder, but I get a load now. But I gotta tell you, after all the beer that's flowed from the brewery, I don't think I deserve to be treated like somebody nobody knows. As if he half expected to be poisoned, Kosick raptly watched Lutiz shake the bottle of bitters over the new glass and drop in another cherry. You tell Brendan I said that. Kosick, who had started to reach for the drink, flinched, reacting as a religious conservative might if Favor had said Jehovah. Lutiz, who'd remained for Robbie's order, had cut off all her hair. Her dark scalp was gristled with the sandpapery nubbins the clippers had left behind.
Kind of radical, she acknowledged.
If anything, she was more striking, nearly 6 feet, with cascading earrings that looked like the crystals from a chandelier. Kosick was taking in the usual byplay between Robbie and the bartender when he suddenly turned toward the room. Beneath his chin, where he showed most of his age in the stringy grayish wattles that hung there, his Adam's apple bobbed several times, and he finally knocked his elbow on Favor's. Even was 3 or 4 feet behind them, holding a glass and yucking it up with the agent who'd just vacated the bar stool.
Oh, shit, Robbie said when he faced back. Figures. She's busting my balls. Hell hath no fury. She's sky high 'cause I gave her 2 weeks' notice.
Kosick spoke for the first time.
2 weeks? Sure. Like I said, I wanted to look normal. I told her I'm ramping down because of Rainey. But she's not going gently. She's breaking real bad on me in the office, and following me around half the time when I leave. I can feel a lawsuit coming on, said Robbie, the way Grandpa felt bad weather in his lumbago.
Kosick watched even in the mirror, his look as unfeeling as some cat's, then broke off and returned to his doodle. Now that she'd been noticed in accord with the plan, even drifted off to a safer distance, while Robbie continued speaking about his problems with her.
I mean, Rollo, I'm asking myself, what the fuck am I doing? You know, maybe it's not that way, and I'm turning her into an enemy. Maybe I'm shooting myself in the foot, letting her go. Could be the uncle was wrong when he said to fire her. I'd like to go over it with him again. Explain. I don't want to piss him off, but maybe we should be thinking about this.
As ever, there was no way to tell if Kosick had even heard Favor's remark. He doodled again for a minute, then turned toward the room, his eyes drifting over Robbie's shoulder as he apparently took in the tumbling scene, the women and men joshing, tippling, holding their cigarettes overhead to avoid accidental burns to passers-by. On the monitor, Rollo looked straight at the three agents and their camera without any change in his unpleasant expression. Watching the tape afterwards, you could see that as he was surveying, he slid the little cocktail napkin he'd been writing on in Robbie's direction. What attracted him, Robbie said subsequently, was that Kosick had unfurled the bad nail and tapped it a couple of times. There was writing amid several geometric shapes, the first 2 lines slanting off from what was inscribed below them. FBI, for sure. Get rid. Now. Don't tell anyone anything. Even Mason. On the replay, Rollo could be seen taking the most fleeting glance to be certain that Robbie had the message. Then he crushed the napkin within his fist and slid it in his pocket.
Whoa,
Robbie said finally. He'd taken a tight grip on the bar.
Motherfuck! Are you sure?
Kosick looked up toward the piano.
Where the hell did this come from, Rollo? Why me? Does anybody know?
Kosick took the bad nail and tapped it on his lips, a little too precise to be random.
Rollo, cut the crap! I'm trying not to have a bowel movement in my trousers here. Give me some help. What's she there for? How do you know all of this? Listen, what I'm hearing is that they've been looking at accident swindlers, okay? Guys setting up phony accidents and suing. Fella I saw thinks that's what this is. Okay? Does that match?
Kosick delivered his lethal glance, then scooped up the four cherries and popped them in his mouth all at once. He ate them after coming to his feet beside his stool. Robbie grabbed Kosick's sleeve between two fingers to keep him from getting away.
"Listen, I'm the one hanging out there, Rollo. Way out there. That's okay, I'm a big boy. But I'll be fucked if I won't be treated with some respect. Anybody's got any more messages for me to take on faith? Want to hear them from the organ grinder, not the monkey. You tell Brendan I said that, too."
Kosick finished chewing with his face lifted into the smoky air, then leaned Favor's way before he departed. It looked as if he was going to whisper some final word, but instead he suddenly took hold of Robbie's necktie. Improbably, Favor jerked back, virtually strangling himself as he braced his arms on the smooth mahogany curve affixed to the leading edge of the granite bar. At the time, it was unclear what was happening, but looking at the tape later, you could see that as Robbie had first been elevated off the seat by Kosick's grip on his tie, Rollo had reached under the bar with the other hand and grabbed Favor's genitals. As Robbie reported it, Kosick had one testicle and his penis inside his fist, and he squeezed for quite some time until he finally whispered in his high, ladylike voice. What he said was too soft for the foxbite to pick up in the clamor, but Robbie heard it and took note as well of the sick smile with which the message was delivered.
"I'm the only organ grinder you know," Kosick had told him.
Chapter 36. Even did not see what was coming. After they left Attitude, she sat in McManus's conference room while Jim went through the debriefings of Favor and the surveillance agents. They replayed the tapes. On the audio, critical points in the conversations were frequently obscured by the piano and the raucous laughter. Occasional odd remarks were sucked in by the directional mics as unpredictably as coins rattling up in a vacuum. Someone complained bitterly about Clinton's proposed tax increase. Another moment revealed the passing of insider information on an upcoming corporate spin-off. The listening took more than an hour and a half. Including the surveillance agents, the core group was now up to 15, far more bodies than there were chairs. They passed around pop and chips, since no one had had dinner, and as ever, tried to figure the next move. Senate was still talking about another shot at Tui.
"As long as you can give me a transplant down there," Robbie answered. There was a lot of laughter.
"Kosick'll pull it off, Stan, the next time I use Brendan's name."
Sennett looked toward McManus for his evaluation. Jim thought there was no chance of getting to Tui.
"They're writing notes for fear of speaking."
"But Robbie passed the frisk. They have to trust him more now."
"Only so much, Stan. These fellows know better than to trust anyone.
They told Robbie about Even because they don't want him to get himself in any deeper. But they know he's radioactive. He's about to get it from the feds, and all bets are off then. You can run all the scenarios you want with Tui. We'll just stack up the tapes he can play during his defense case. He's never going to step in quicksand with Robbie."
"They all do," Sennett shot back. "If you find the right thing, they all do."
His eyes flashed over to me. This was a bit of prosecutorial parlor talk, probably best not shared in front of a defense lawyer. Jim's advice was to abandon the frontal assault. The best approach to Brendan was from the flanks. They had to hope that someone turned on him. Someone like Kosick or Malaki might be able to catch Tui unawares. If they kept pushing with Robbie, they could blow that chance. The eminent good sense of what Jim was saying seemed to win over everyone else. But Stan was unwilling to say quit. His great scheming intelligence worked in service of the gratification he got from winning in the direct showdown. The triumph he craved was to out-duel Brendan one-on-one. Near the end of their argument, the two stepped outside. When they returned, McManus waved Even into his office. She still didn't realize what he was going to say.
"We're pulling you in," he said. "It's over."
She felt like one of those eggs from which, as kids, they'd blown out the yolk and the white to make Easter decorations. That frail. That hollow.
"Because you're worried about what Kosick meant about getting rid of me?"
"We're not going to wait to find out, but that's not the problem. You're burned, and Robbie's supposed to know that. He has to get you out of the office on Monday. There's nothing left for UCA Evan Miller to do."
"What does Senate think?"
"This isn't Senate's call, and he recognizes the logic."
"Maybe I can stay in town, though? Maybe they'll make a move."
"Nope," he said. "I'm done saying I dare you. There's no operational need. After Monday, it's adios."
She felt absolutely desperate. She couldn't go back.
"Go home," he said. "See your family. You've got accumulated leave for months. We'll probably pull you back when we start the flips. You won't miss the grand finale. But for now, I want you out of harm's way."
"Orders," he said.
He watched her absorb it, seeing how little good he was doing.
"I told you," he said. "This isn't easy. The whole journey, start to finish. It's rugged."
When Jim opened the door, Sennett was waiting. She hoped he was there to argue with McManus, but instead he took her hand. He said all the right words, and meant them as near as she could tell.
"Extraordinary," she heard him say. He said, "courage," more than once. He said, "patriot."
"The people of this district will never know how much they owe you, Dee Dee. You're a tremendous pearl. Everyone in the Bureau is proud of you, and I'm so honored to have worked with you."
They said that about Stan, that he could scrape bottom and then reach the stars. Whatever bitterness he felt over McManus's decision, he allowed it to have no impact on the way he spoke to her. His dark eyes glistened. At the oddest moments with this guy, you saw what was really important to him. She felt as if she were getting another Olympic medal. Then the three of them went back to the conference room and announced that Evan was coming in. The 15 or so people assembled stood and applauded. Klecker popped an empty chip bag, and every person in the room hugged her or jostled her shoulders.
It was happening, she realized. Really happening. She was done.
For several weeks now, a large garbage truck, painted in the red and blue colors of county sanitation, had been periodically touring the alley behind Brendan Toohey's home, picking up the trash from every house on the block. The truck, with its two-story walrus back and predatory iron maw on the rear, was the property of the DEA, but it was lent freely to the other federal agencies and even had a predetermined route each day, albeit one that frequently covered an area 100 miles wide. Because no warrant is required to seize property the law views as abandoned, the confiscation of trash has become a standard armament in the war on crime. Toohey's neighbor's trash was discarded, while the dark green bags from Brendan's cans were delivered to Joe Amari so that he and his crew could go through them with rubber gloves. Interesting tidbits had turned up. Brendan, improbably, had a deep interest in the lives of the saints, and there were several receipts each day for money orders, which the IRS bloodhounds would trace when the investigation surfaced. Early Monday morning, when Evan arrived at McManus's for a final debriefing before going up to Fever and Dinnerstein for the last time, Joe Amari placed the cocktail napkin on which Rollo Kosick had written his warning to Robbie Friday night on the conference table. It was already in a plastic folder, and every UCA entered to take a look, as if it were a piece of the true cross. The napkin, sporting Attitude's black-lined logo and the heavy geometric doodles in the corner, had been torn in four, but the pieces fit neatly. It would go out for fingerprinting and handwriting analysis as soon as Favor identified it. He arrived at 9:30 to set the scenario for Evan's curtain call upstairs. After the weekend at home, he again looked a wreck.
That's it.
He smiled as he held the plastic envelope, but it seemed to require a second effort. Kosick was a lock now, dead bang on obstruction, and without much room on the conspiracy overall. McManus wanted to start planning an effort to flip him. Rollo was key. There was still no direct evidence against Tui, nothing to actually prove he was in league with Kosick and the others. McManus gave the napkin a second look and asked Robbie about the reference to Mason, which he hadn't mentioned Friday night. Favor shrugged. Apparently Brendan figured he'd gone to Mason because he hadn't knocked on Tooley's door. Robbie went up to his office first. When Evan got there, the receptionist, Phyllida, a lean Australian whom Robbie had employed because he loved her accent, told Evan that he wanted to see her. When she closed the door to Robbie's office, an unexpected swell of melancholy gripped her. She experienced the fine cityscape through the broad windows and the harmony of the spring light, and took in yet again that she was leaving. In memory, she'd realized this experience was going to be similar to hockey, another broad marker in her life, something to live up to, another stream she couldn't step in twice.
So, he said.
His eyes were dead.
Blah, blah, blah. You're fired.
He should have been sticking with the cover. Evan was supposed to yell at him and call him names, which was likely to bring some of the office folks close to the door. The idea was to create the impression of a final lover's row. But he clearly wasn't ready to begin.
So, do we get together again, or is this sayonara? He asked her.
She was leaving in half an hour. Amari was going to take her to the airport. She told him that McManus said she would be back whenever they began the effort to flip the investigation's leading targets. He sat in his tall black chair and shook his head, smiling at himself.
You know, he told her, I always thought one of the greatest things about women was they stuck around.
He looked in the direction of the red rug for a while.
Times change, he said.
She smiled sadly at that, and then, on impulse, crossed the room and hugged him, waiting what seemed to be quite some time for him to let her go.
You better raise your voice now, she told him. Let them hear. You're fired, like you mean it.
You're fired, he said listlessly, and then, staring miserably at her, began to cry. Don't take it as a compliment. I cry about everything these days. He got out his handkerchief. You better do the yelling. Now's your chance. Tell them what a lying heap of dung I am. She settled for slamming the door, and as she emerged, muttering under her breath. Four steps away, she stopped in order to pull back from the precipice of disordering emotions. Bonita, with her raccoon eyes and piles of black hair, brittle as fiberglass, was staring. So was Oretta from the file room. Perfect, Evan thought. Perfect play. Midweek, she flew out to Denver to see Merrill. She arrived Thursday, and on Friday afternoon they drove up to Vail to see the brand new condo. It had cost $750,000, and Evan felt she could put her hand through the walls if she knocked on them too hard. But Merrill and Roy were thrilled, as they always were, by their possessions. Together they showed off everything in the place, the patio, the mountain view, the hot tub, the rumpus room furniture, even the stove and microwave. In Roy's view, this was the same thing as Jesus handing them a report card telling them they were doing good. Roy spent 5 days a week riding on airplanes. Evan had picked up the phone sometimes when she was visiting and heard him say he was in the most ridiculous places, Sumatra or Abu Dhabi. But the longer she knew him, the more she realized he was a lot like her father, clinging to a few simple things and, otherwise, completely baffled. Merrill's girls, ages 14 to 3, were wonderful. Grace and Hope, Melody and Rose, were all blondes, and all their mom's kids, each with painted nails and arguments about how Merrill should do their hair,
Even took especially to Rose, the littlest, who was said to favor her aunt. It wasn't really a compliment. Poor Rose had not been born with the silky, long-legged look of her mother. She was what Merrill called a pudge. Rose was never neat, and at the age of 3 already somewhat frantic, incorrigibly committed to screaming whenever she wanted to be heard. But for whatever reason, she loved her aunt. She drew even into her games and could already throw a ball accurately. Saturday night, dinner got messed up. Roy was on the patio, getting exercised about the gas grill that wouldn't ignite, and the meat sat out there with him, as the light dwindled and shrank the bulk from the mountains. The smell of cedar rose up from the forest floor as the chill began to drain the little bit of moisture from the air. Merrill, trying to ignore Roy's growing agitation, finally fed the smaller girl's noodles, while she and Evan ate half a wedge of brie and drank most of a bottle of wine. Evan tried to entertain the little ones. Rose told her that Mama said she'd be the flower girl when her Aunt Dee Dee got married. "Oh, honey," she said, "I don't think your Auntie Dee Dee is the marrying kind." Merrill, who was still unpacking boxes in the kitchen, heard this and sang out with a story about a colleague of Roy's, a woman named Karen Bircher, who at the age of 41 had gone from being a powerhouse career gal to a mom at home in the space of 15 months. "It just takes the right guy, Dee," Merrill told her, crossing into the small dining room, carrying a tray of glassware. Lightly, laughingly, actually strangely happy, Evan said, "Oh, I don't think it's a guy." Who knows why these things happen? Her sister stood stock still, her anxious glances divided between the tray of orphors, which she plainly feared she might drop, and Evan. Merrill was terrified. No other way to describe the look that evaporated much of her beauty. She literally snatched up Rose, stating that it was time for bed, and ran away with her daughter. When Merrill returned to the kitchen, she was furious. Evan was stacking plates in the cupboard. "Please, Dee Dee," Merrill whispered, "please don't ever say anything like that to Roy." Roy. Evan laughed again. She was instantly afraid it was another of those moments when her reactions were dead wrong. But she was so happy, and the thought of saying anything to Roy was purely amusing. Simple Roy was just a fellow walking through a tunnel looking for the light. "Oh, hun," Evan said, "it's been 15 years before I could even say it to myself." She still felt like a bubble rising in a soft drink. She found her sister's eyes. It took a moment for Merrill to reorganize herself. She was working her way back toward something. Love. Merrill loved her. In their family, they loved each other best. And there was a reason for that, because there was a piece of one another they always carried around, the someone else they might have been. "Oh, sweetheart, sweetheart," Merrill said, and opened her arms to her sister. They stood there in the little pantry, laughing and crying both. But for just a moment, because Melody walked in, upset about the ravaged mess Grace had made of the hair of one of her dolls. Knowing nothing else to do, Merrill reached down and hugged her daughter urgently, and grabbed at Dee Dee, and took her in as well. Chapter 37. During the week, Evan was gone. Nothing happened. By Wednesday or Thursday, Stan and McManus had realized that Tui and his people were hunkered down, waiting to see what the G was going to do with fever. After Kosick's note to Robbie was presented to her, the chief judge had authorized the installation of a fiber-optic camera in Kosick's office to augment the bug Alf had placed in the phone weeks before. She allowed the equipment to remain on throughout business hours, but the results were no more revealing. A couple of phone calls, one from Sherm Crowthers, were suspect,
but Kosick, according to the surveillance agents patrolling the courthouse, had gone down to Crowther's chambers for whatever talk took place there. On Wednesday, Kosick told Milaki during a long conversation about various unserved summonses that he'd heard that Fever's girlfriend had left town. There was no specification how Kosick knew that, although presumably it came from Tui, who would have learned the news from Mort. The presiding judge appeared in Kosick's office once or twice, just standing in the doorway, but their exchanges were innocuous. Rollo referred to him as Your Honor. More significant conversations were in all likelihood reserved for home. By Friday, Senate had concocted a new scenario, securing McManus's agreement to make one last-ditch effort against Tui directly. When Even returned to Des Moines late on Sunday from Colorado, there was a message on her machine from McManus. "You're back in business," he told her. She caught the 7 a.m. plane Monday morning and was in Kendall by 8:30. Amari and McManus picked her up at the airport and drove her into the center city. At 9:30 a.m., Even arrived in the reception area of Fever and Dinnerstein, accompanied by two agents from the local field office of the FBI. She asked for Robbie again. Phyllida knew enough to realize that Even's appearance was trouble. Over the intercom, Favor told Phyllida to say he wasn't in, but when she relayed the message, Even removed her FBI credentials from her purse and snapped them open as if it were a potent magic trick. Phyllida was bright, but she couldn't make any sense of it. She scooted her little castered chair back from the reception desk until she bumped into the wall behind her, placing a narrow hand with pink polish near her heart. Even swept past her with the two agents trailing. She threw open Robbie's door and strode to the glass desk where he was speaking on the phone. He looked miserable, worse than when she left. He was losing weight, she realized. He caught himself halfway to a smile as she approached. "Robert Fever!" she called in a voice resounding throughout the office. She flashed her creds. "Special Agent D.D. Kurzweil of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, this is a subpoena, Duques Tecum, requiring you to appear before the special June 1993 grand jury on Friday, June 25th at 10 a.m. She threw it on his desk and turned heel. Robbie, in roll, scurried behind her, spewing curses. By 11, he was at Rollo Kosick's office. He had no difficulty appearing haggard and frantic. I knew he had had a terrible weekend. On Friday, Rainey, much earlier than the doctors had predicted, had lost her ability to move her right wrist enough to operate the computer mouse. For 48 hours, she had lain there with no ability to communicate except by blinking her eyes or tapping her fingers. By Sunday, a friend from the computer business had attached a new tracking device, laser-controlled through the movement of her eyes. Yet the period Rainey had spent locked in, without voice, had been a peek into an intolerable future. She had resolved to take no further measures to prolong her life. When he appeared on the screen in the surveillance van, where we were all watching, Robbie's anguish seemed as palpable as in Kabuki. Kosick's office was tiny, formerly reserved for a law clerk. There were bookshelves on three sides, all empty. In Brendan's style, Kosick did not bother with a picture or memento of any kind. The many court papers he dealt with stood on either side of his desk in two neat stacks. With the benefit of hard wiring through the phone lines, Alf was able to zoom the camera in and out via a handheld remote. Kosick was yawningly impassive when Robbie came through the door and dropped the subpoena on his desk. But for the dates, it was the same as the document served on Robbie last September by the IRS. It asked for the records of the secret checking account at River National. While Kosick read it, Robbie said, "They know." As always, Kosick offered no response. "I need to talk to him, Rollo." Kosick's eyes rolled upward, the whites prominent. "Rollo, that's where I get the cash. That account. They know. They have to talk to him." Kosick seemed to realize he had no choice about speaking.
I don't see the point in that. I've got to, Rollo. I haven't told Mason shit, but I have to tell him something now. This checking account looks pretty funny with all the cash flying out of it. We've got to figure out how I can keep Morty clean. I'm not sure anybody'll believe it if I say he didn't know where the money was going. And some of the things I might say, that wouldn't be so hot for his license anyway. I need to know what Brendan can swing over at bed.
Rollo had shaken his head metronomically throughout Robbie's remarks.
Barking up the wrong tree. He can't help you with that.
Favor feigned fury. He picked the subpoena up again and threw it down. He leaned over Kosick's desk.
This is my fucking law license. This is God knows how long in a joint with God knows whose joint up my can. I'll handle the weight, but I need help. And I need it right now, Rollo. I gotta say the right thing.
For Kosick, for Tui, the dilemma was exactly what McManus had described. They had to keep Robbie on the reservation, but not say or do anything that might lead to further troubles for them down the line if Favor didn't stand up. Rollo pondered with a finger on his lips, the bad nail revealed. He said they'd get back to him. As Robbie neared the door, Kosick finally volunteered something.
It's too bad your dick ain't a weather vane, Robbie. With all the time you spend waving it around, you would have seen this coming.
There was no further word from them for more than 24 hours. But on Tuesday afternoon, Milaki appeared in Robbie's reception area without warning. Favor called Alf, hoping to get the fox bite upstairs instantly. Instead, Klecker told Robbie just to leave his telephone on speaker. Downstairs, Alf rolled tape and muted his end so there would be no telltale sound from Robbie's phone as it broadcast the conversation. Phyllida then showed Milaki back. Sig was impressed by the stylish furnishings.
Is that real client skin you got there on the walls?
Just the Polex. They're the only ones who believe it's a facelift when I ask them to bend over.
Bonita had brought Sig a Coke, and he excused himself after he belched.
How's your golf game?
He asked. About as rusty as my clubs.
Couple guys thought you'd like to catch an early round before work. Out at Rob Roy?
Brendan's club.
This is on the QT, okay? They don't open up for play until 8:30, so these guys sneak out to number 5.
Milaki gave him instructions. Robbie was to park his car at the far end of the club lot, near the maintenance shed, and then walk down a quarter of a mile or so on a path through the public forest. Robbie knew the spot from childhood picnics.
There's a little lake there?
Pond, right, said Milaki. Tee off at 6 a.m.
Called to the conference room along with Stan, I heard the tape that afternoon. It sounded as if it had been recorded in a canyon. How'd he react when you mentioned the lake? I asked Robbie. Favor responded with a faint, fatalistic smile. It was a remote setting. We were all thinking the same thing. Even Sennett. I want the surveillance tight, Sennett told Amari. I want guys dressed up as the birds in the trees, whatever it takes. I don't want Robbie out of sight. Amari shrunk up his mouth sardonically. We're on their turf. Literally. I bet you Tui can play that golf course in the dark. He knows when a twig is moved. And I gotta get my guys in place in the middle of the night? We'll be damn lucky if one of them doesn't fall in that lake and drown.
They're setting it up to feel secure, said Sennett. Tui thinks he won't have to look over his shoulder. If you do it right, Robbie, he'll let his hair down. He's got to make sure you'll stand up and take the hit for all of them. You just have to get him to say it out loud.
I cornered McManus before I left. I wanted to know what he would say if I insisted that Robbie wear body armor, a bulletproof Kevlar vest. He might be able to hide it under a jacket. Jim turned over the idea. He skipped what I later realized was the correct response. Up close, it would be a headshot anyway.
Look, George, I can't tell you it's completely safe, because it isn't. But we're going to have surveillance all over the area. If anybody shows up we don't like or don't know, anybody the Kendall County agents recognize as hooked up, if it looks like Malaki or Kosick are packing, if anything's wrong, I'm closing down, George. That's my word to you. His light eyes did not leave mine. But I don't see them writing Robbie secret messages and then disappearing him 10 days later. They'd have made a move last week if they were going to do that. That's the logic, at least. Then he turned his palms up, acknowledging how little any of these efforts at prediction were worth in the end. Chapter 38. We met at the Hickory Stick Mall, one of those vast emporia where the immense parking lot, all but empty in the still darkness of 4:30 a.m., bore silent comment on the trivial appetites that would have this place swarming by midday. A large reader board for the multiplex, the only thing illuminated against a ghostly sky tinctured with the first gray drops of early light, advertised a number of the films I hadn't yet seen. Last Action Hero, Jurassic Park. For the moment, I had no need for imaginary adventures. As cover, we'd agreed to wear fishing attire, posing as a group of Center City yahoos trying to land a crappie or two before work. I'd borrowed a khaki vest with zippers and pockets from Billy, one of my sons. The surveillance van moved around the huge lot, picking up each of us, our signal no more subtle than our parking lights. Robbie and I were together on the north side of the mall. We had only a few moments to talk before the gray van came by. Robbie had been up all night with Rainey. Looking him over, I realized that Robbie Favor had turned an important corner in his life in the last few weeks. He remained good-looking, but worry and sleeplessness and depression and poor diet had worn on him in a way likely to be permanent. They had stolen some of his glory. Yet he'd maintained the show-must-go-on spirit, and had done his best to look his part. He had on a snappy golf shirt with a rich fire-stitch weave and fancy golf spikes, wingtip style, with Kelties over the laces. I told him he could still say no to this. "No, I can't," he answered. "I always knew I was going to get Brendan, or die trying." The best news, he said, was that he'd be in the woods, so he wouldn't have to worry about taking a dump in his trousers. In the van, I asked for a minute with Stan. As we stepped out, McManus handed each of us a pole. Neither Sennett nor I was much of an outdoorsman, and McManus briefly called us back, warning us, completely deadpan, to watch out for the hooks. Stan and I stood out among the vacant, painted stripes of the parking lot, 100 yards from various expensive department stores, pretending to test the flex of the rods. I told Stan that my client seemed fairly concerned he was about to be killed. "Won't happen," said Sennett. "If I didn't think we could protect him, I wouldn't be going forward. Don't let him back out on me, George." "That wasn't the issue," I said. I just wanted Stan to assure Robbie that he'd virtually sing the Star-Spangled Banner every time he mentioned Favor's name to the sentencing judge. He did it, but Robbie didn't look much happier. In the van, we reviewed the scenario one more time, and Alf readied the equipment. Odd said Milwaukee wouldn't frisk Robbie again for fear that one more insult might drive him into the government's arms. Even so, with Robbie wearing neither boots nor a suit jacket, hiding the fox bite was a challenge. Considering everything, Alf had decided to secrete the units in the crown of a wide-brimmed Australian-style raffia golf hat, concealing them under a sturdy rubberized lining. Klecker made Robbie go through several swings to be certain the headgear would stay on. The one serious problem was that in order to fit the recorder and transmitter within the slender space available, Alf had to use a smaller battery. That meant Robbie couldn't meander through the round with Tui waiting for him to get conversational at the 19th hole. The fox bite would run out of power after an hour and 40 minutes.
A staticky squall of radio reports reached the van from the agents positioned in the public forest. The communications were easily overheard and sometimes unsettling. The surveillance was not as comprehensive as planned. Amari's guys had erected deer blinds in four of the oaks that bordered the golf course. The process of building them in the middle of the night, with the county forest police occasionally sweeping down the neighboring roads, had been both comical and hair-raising. But even with night vision binoculars, it had been impossible to fully scope out the terrain. As light began to perk up, the agents were reporting that there were a number of spots, especially the deep bunkers of the sand traps, where Robbie would be completely out of sight. There had been some discussion of putting the portable camera in Robbie's golf bag, but it would have been almost impossible to keep the lens trained in the right direction. Instead, the four surveillance agents in the trees were each equipped with cameras, two standard video cams that would record in color, and two of the 2.4 gigahertz models that would transmit a picture to the van. A cordon of additional agents would be poised at the perimeter of the course with binoculars. Joggers and walkers, out with the first sunlight, were not uncommon, but Sennett for once seemed unconcerned about the risks of detection.
"If we get blown, we get blown," he said.
Nobody could get word to Tui anyway in the middle of the golf course. Sennett, to his credit, was determined not to lose sight of Robbie. Finally, at 5:30 a.m., it was time to go. Amari had a unit trailing Tui, and they radioed that Brendan and Kosick had just pulled out of the garage of the stone house in Latterly. Two surveillance cars, new Novas that had been fitted over with the rusted bodies of earlier models, swept into the mall lot to follow Robbie to the country